This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
All right, we're getting comfy here in our new time slot. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here and spending time, part of your weekend with us. Alongside of Dr. Mike O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell. You can always catch Dr. Mike O'Neill at O'NeillResearch.com. That's his day job. Marketing, public opinion research, really good stuff on that website. But you're looking very tan today.
I just got back from Mexico.
From Mexico? Yeah. How long were you spent out there?
Four days on the beach.
Nice. On the beach. You were just with the pina colada and getting it done.
Looking out at the sunset.
Nice. And, what part?
Yeah. Rocky Point.
Okay.
Puerto Penasco to the locals.
Puerto Penasco. You don't have any fears of going down to Mexico, huh?
Oh, you definitely shouldn't go there. I want the beach to myself.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, look, and I do want to talk about that. Yeah. I want to look. Arizona, it's almost like we're in a mini war with this immigration deal. It's almost like we're in a mini war with Mexico, and then we hear U.S. travel warnings and don't go down to Mexico, and there's drug dealers and there's violence, and there's young Mormon couples getting abducted when they come from Goodyear. I don't want to go down there. I got a family of four. I don't think it's safe to go down there. You think otherwise.
Let me explain to you, and I've taken my kids there. I think in reality it's a lot like there are gang wars in East L.A. Does that keep you from going to San Francisco?
I'm from L.A. I didn't see one gang war. Yeah, I didn't see one gang battle.
Forget about L.A. Does that keep you from going to San Francisco? The stuff, I followed it closely. I own property down there. And I go all the time, and I have done so for years. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I talk to a lot of people about this, and the reactions are completely bifurcated. On the one hand, there's the people who have never been there who have this sort of scare aura. They read a couple of pieces, and they make an impression of an entire country based on that. Then there's the old-timers who go there all the time, and basically, there are places in Mexico that I'm as chicken as they come. I'm not going to Juarez. I'm not going to Tijuana. There's a whole lot of other places down there I would not go. But Puerto Penasco has basically been off the beaten track. The road goes from there to here. By the way, that road, that's an interesting story in itself. Mm-hmm. The road from Lukeville, which is the Arizona border, to Puerto Penasco, you know who built that road?
Ev Meekum?
No.
Oh, okay.
That road was built in World War II by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Interesting.
You know why?
Why is that?
Because the plan was that when the Japanese bombed Long Beach, San Francisco, mm-hmm. Oakland, and we needed a port, our alternate port on the Pacific was going to be Puerto Penasco. But if we used that as a port, we needed a land bridge into the United States, and that was the road that they built. And I was curious about this the first time I made the trip because I said, God, this road is off, has a high resemblance to US 85, which is, you know, the road on the Arizona side of the border. And the answer when I looked into it was, yeah, it was built by the same people.
Well, and that's nice. I think that's great. You found Puerto Penasco, and it's a nice place. You found a spot. What about looking over our shoulders? What about the federales? And I'm not trying to poke fun at it here. I'm talking about serious dangers about crossing the border and then attempting to come back.
As I said, there are places, lots of them in Mexico that I wouldn't set foot on, but I've looked at the maps of incidents and things like that because I had an interest. As I said, I own property. I want to go down there. I don't want to go down there. I'm not foolhardy. I'm not even on the adventurous side. But they have essentially been unscathed from this. It's not on the beaten path of between any population center and anywhere else. If you look at the roads, there's a road that goes from the Arizona border, Lukeville on the Arizona side, Sonoita on the Mexican side, and it's Route 8. Okay. Mexico Route 8 goes to Puerto Penasco, and then it stops. Okay. It's sort of a dead end, and it's not been on the beaten track. And essentially, it's interesting. When all the sort of drug war scare started to heat up, it was...
But there's a reality to it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. In Mexico.
Right. Okay.
Absolutely. I am not saying that there's no drug war in Mexico, though the drugs were there first. And that didn't cause much of a problem until the government started to clamp down and then they started to fight for turf. But it's not the entirety of the country. Just like we got gang wars in East L.A. and other places. There are places, heck, I live in Tempe. There's a place, you know,
hotbed for gang activity.
6 or 7 miles from my house, you can go to neighborhoods in South Phoenix that I wouldn't care to drive through.
Okay.
And that have drive-by shootings and things like that. And by the way, there is a lot of actual social science, social psychology behind this. And the principle is the following. All of us do this because it's a human trait. We systematically overestimate how safe things that we are familiar with, like our own neighborhood. In other words, wherever you live, it's likely that your neighborhood is, even if it's safe, is probably a little bit more dangerous than you think it is. Systematically also, the more foreign a neighborhood is to you, and that can mean race, language, culture, appearance, the more foreign it looks to you, the more you systematically overestimate how dangerous it is.
Okay.
So we cross the border, and we're no longer in America, and that makes us a little ill at ease. But as a function, though, of how much foreign travel we've done. The people who've done a lot of foreign travel, it's no big deal to. People who've never crossed the border, the first time they do, it's all ill at ease. And then you have the background of some of the stories, some of which are real. Even the real ones, though, tend to be very distant from this location.
Right.
And it just plays into our psychology. It's not unlike the phenomena we're afraid of airplane trips because we hear about a crash, but we're far more likely to get killed within 5 miles of our own home driving home. Why? Well, first of all, we spend a lot more time there. And secondly, familiarity. We get careful. We get comfortable. We lose our attentiveness.
In that familiarity, we like to brag that we're a melting pot here in the United States. We're a melting pot here in Arizona. We're not. We're very segregated. We segregate ourselves. We flock with our own kind. Whether you like it or not, we flock with our own kind. So it is kind of intimidating thinking there's drug wars down there, and they don't look like us.
Well, interesting. The melting pot business, I think, by the second or third generation, that I think has a lot of truth in it.
Okay.
But not for the first generation.
Ah.
First generation, people keep their languages, and this is not just Spanish or Mexicans. Right now, this was Italians and Germans mm-hmm. and Poles and whatever in their first generation. Anyway, we will be back to discuss this further in just a few minutes. This is the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
All right, all you worrywarts out there, you can stop the search, call off the dogs. Dr. Mike O'Neill made it back from Mexico. I know we were all worried that Mexico would grab him and some sort of federale would land him in some godforsaken dungeness prison, but you made it back. All the way from Puerto Peñasco. Great job.
Rule one is behave yourself. There's a lot of kids in particular go down there and think that they're in a lawless country and act out and do things that get themselves arrested here. And lo and behold,
come on.
Lo and behold, they get arrested there for the same things.
But my thoughts turn to when I think about going to or from Mexico. Now, did you drive?
I did.
Okay. So my first thought is the border. Border security, yeah. Getting there, getting back, dogs and drugs and people with guns. Talk to me about that. Tell me I'm being paranoid.
And let me take you through what it's like and what it was like there a few years ago.
Okay.
You go down on U.S. 85, Arizona 85.
Let's start with a few years ago. What it was like.
Desolate. It's an empty desert. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the border. And I looked at this place in Google Maps. It's like 25 people live there. And they're all working in the border station, and there's a filling station and a place to buy candy and gum, and then you cross the border into Sonora, Mexico, which is a reasonable sized town. I don't know the population, but it's a real town. There's real people and real stores, as contrasted to the U.S. side, which is really just a border.
Are there
station.
The taco stands on the side?
Oh yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Good night, they're awesome.
Yep.
Yes, okay.
Yep.
Go ahead.
But you go down there now, and the first thing you notice is the ICE, the Border Patrol presence, maybe starting 25, 30 miles out. Okay.
The out meaning towards the border, as you're driving towards the border.
Yes, okay. As you approach the border. Well, first thing now is about 60 miles north, there's a permanent station, which you go through on. We go through in both directions, but on the way north, they check you out. That used to be a mobile station, okay? In other words, not only did you cross the border going north, but you had to cross through. It used to be just one check, and they moved where that check was. The idea was that if somebody hops over the fence, which is easy enough, then they got to travel 100 miles to Phoenix, and you're going to catch them somewhere on the way if they get in a vehicle. And those stations were mobile, so you didn't know where to get back on the border. Though I'll make an observation, back then there was one easy way to get across by road, is because those stations were mobile, the time to go north and cross was when it was, not very often does this happen, but when it rained cats and dogs, I noticed they stayed in their car.
Right. Makes
so
sense.
You could get in a car and they tended not to stop you. Well, Border ICE figured this out, and so they put up these two great big white U-shaped umbrellas at two different locations. And now, even if it's raining or it's 110 degrees out, it'll protect you in the sun. The problem is, because these stations are no longer mobile, they know where they are.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to, now they're not going to stop doing it in the rain, but you know where they are.
Right.
It's tricky. You got it in and off the road, and you can get caught there.
Okay.
But the other thing that you notice, and this is in the last 3 years or so, is, about, 10 miles before the border thereabouts, there is this huge complex, think three super Walmarts, and it's ICE. It's border control agents. There's an armada of vehicles, SUVs. There's all kinds of stuff. The number of border folks that you see is way, way up. And I got so many people now, they even talk to you going south. They used to be on the way south. They wouldn't even admit, you just drove through on the American side. And the Mexican side, they check you out only to make sure that you're not bringing in goods that they want to tax. You're allowed $75 a head.
Oh, okay.
So if you want to bring, big screen TVs or whatever down there, they want to tax them. That's what their concern is going south. On the way north, they ask about fruits and vegetables.
What is it with fruits and vegetables?
I think
everyone says no, but everybody's got about a bushel of apples in the back.
Flies, and whatever you're going to be bringing with them.
Interesting.
The fruits and vegetables, obviously, non-documented immigrants is a concern, and drugs is
probably don't want to bring either of those two. Yeah. Maybe an apple or two you can squeeze by. Bring human or two, not a good idea.
The worst thing they'll do is probably take your apple. But
yeah, okay.
On the way down, the apples they're concerned about are computers.
So okay, nice. So, but let's talk about on your way down. Pretty easy to get into Mexico.
Oh, yeah. That's no problem. In fact, I tell people, they now want you to have a passport. And they said, do I need to get a passport, to go to Mexico? I said, no. But you only need it if you want to get back in the U.S.
Oh, okay. Nice. So you do need a passport.
In fact, you do need a passport or something called a passport card, which is half the price, easier to get.
Really?
But it's only good for land-only transport into Canada or Mexico.
Oh, okay.
So
it's like $50 to get one.
Instead of $100.
Yeah. Okay.
And so if the only thing you're going to do is go to the beach in Rocky Point, that's a good way out. Now, incidentally, the whole business with the passport is what really cut down the traffic to Rocky Point far more than the whole drug war scare. And the reason is that the market for Rocky Point has always been spur of the moment. People say, let's go and go this weekend. And then what happened is the day they postponed the requirement for years, and nobody ever thought they were going to do it. Finally, about a year and a half ago, they said, no, that's it. You have to have this in order to get back in. And the next day, the amount of traffic going down there just plummeted.
Oh, I could imagine.
Because you have to think ahead. Getting a passport is about an 8-week process. You fill out some forms, you prove your identity and your legality and all that, and you send it into Washington. It takes about 8 weeks. So you have to think in advance.
Right.
So if you're wanting to go down there this summer, it's probably too late.
Now, I've always thought that we played nice. We played pretty friendly in the sandbox with the Mexican government, with the Mexican people. I think coming from Arizona, it seems just, and this is from a layman's sense, it's kind of a feeling I get, is that our relationship is a little strained. Do you feel that going down there, or is this something, once again, I'm reading into it?
I think it depends on who you talk to.
Okay.
You know, if you go down to the beach area and you're going to restaurants, you're going to stores, there's no problem. I mean, we're the market for those folks, okay? Mm-hmm. If there's resentment or whatever, you don't see it. But those are folks who are making money off of it. You know, there's a lot of Arizonans in places like Nogales that are making money on the reverse. It turns out that most dry goods, like everything from watches to furniture to, you know, anything you'd buy in a store except for food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and food is, this is also true of food, is considerably cheaper here than it is in Mexico.
Really?
And so in Nogales, there used to be a daily flood of Mexicans who would cross the border to shop in American stores and take the goods back to Mexico.
You know, I see a lot of that. I watched that on Nat Geo, mm-hmm. the Border Wars. I watched that. A lot of people just saying they're coming up to shopping. Just coming up to shop, going to head on back down. But they're coming through. A lot of them are coming through the San Diego border crossing, which is a nightmare.
Yeah,
to back and forth to Tijuana is just, it's absolutely, coming back, coming north through Tijuana, you're in a 15-car line, and that's if it's a off day.
There was a period a couple of years ago where you had, on holiday weekends, you had up to an 8-hour week to get back.
Oh, forget that nonsense.
It's over now, but they've upgraded.
But it's good to hear. It's good to hear that Mexico's feeling good, looking good, and I'm blowing it a little bit out of proportion. The Zimmerman and Martin, well, the George Zimmerman trial. We can't call it the Trayvon Martin trial, but the George Zimmerman trial, the results are in. I want to get Dr. O'Neill's opinion on this. We're going to go a little back and forth. I have a feeling we differ on a few of the points. That's coming up next. You're listening to The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Dr. Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell with you. Thanks for being with us. You know, he's gone www.mikeoneill.org for blogs, articles, opinions. Never does he have an opinion. And some pretty cool videos on there as well. Zimmerman trial, I'm going to go to you. You are a public opinion guy. You are a public polling guy. So I want to get into what the public thought next. First, I want to ask you, verdict handed down, you're watching the news, you see this, surprised, not surprised, your first reaction?
Let me dissect this a little bit
and
get there in a roundabout kind of way. I think we can separate out, there's two classes of facts here. The first are the things that we know. Okay, there are some things I think about which there's no disagreement. Zimmerman was aware of past break-ins in the neighborhood. He was angry. He saw Martin. He found him suspicious. He called 911. The operator said, stay in the car, let the police handle. By the way, that's pretty good advice. And
did they say stay in the car, police handle? Or did they say, we don't? He said, I'm going to follow him. He said, we don't need you to do that.
I
don't need you to do that and keep your butt in that seat are two different things.
And by the way, did you know I used to be a cop? That's pretty good. That's pretty good advice.
I did not know that.
So Zimmerman ignores that. He follows and confronts Martin. We know that Zimmerman has a gun in his pocket. We know that Martin is unarmed. We know that at the end of an altercation, Zimmerman shoots Martin. I think all of those are pretty much undisputed fact.
Okay.
What we don't know is a whole lot of other stuff, like who hit who first, what the exact sequence of events was, who's on top, and who's calling for help. Mm-hmm. All of the testimony in that area is pretty self-serving or predictable. Every family member swore that the guy and friend swore that the guy who was asking for help was their guy. So that's the disputable stuff. We have also an additional question was, which I find interesting, maybe not legally significant, but I find interesting, is if Zimmerman did not have a gun in his pocket, would he have followed Trayvon Martin, who he thought was dangerous and suspicious? That's, to me, an interesting question. To go beyond that, let me first of all say that I have a certain amount of trepidation, I think, of second-guessing any jury verdict. These people sat through days and days of testimony. And
but
we,
you have a vibe.
Oh, sure.
Once you hear the verdict read, you at least have some sort of response, some sort of feeling.
Okay. The thing that I keep on coming back to is, why on earth did he have to get out of that car? You know, okay. No good was going to come by that.
Right.
You know,
I will tell you, no good would come of this trial. It doesn't matter if he was sent to jail. I don't think good would come of that. As he's just acquitted, no good would come. This thing going to trial after the FBI said, nope, nothing to, there's no trial here. There's no charges. We're not going to arrest him. The Sanford PD, same thing. The DA, same thing. Everyone said, we've got nothing. Once they bowed to political pressure and went to court, nothing good could have happened.
And the jury came down with a verdict, and I think the system is that we have to honor that. I also think that the federal government probably should not pursue the civil rights violation. You get one bite at the apple, except for absolutely egregious cases where something has been done and it is so obviously
He shows up in a hood, right? He shows up in a white hood and robe, right?
And where you're clear that the local system is not going to deliver justice. I think I have some concerns about the verdict, but I think you have to honor it. Now, that said, I think the Martin family has more than a cause for civil action. Their son got killed. He was out doing nothing wrong that anybody has been able to in any way prove. Their son gets killed. That's a civil action. But the standards on that are completely different. In a criminal case, when there is uncertainty about what happened, the benefit of the doubt goes to the defendant. And you say, we don't convict people who we think are probably guilty. We got to be pretty darn sure. Mm-hmm. In a civil case, it's 51-49 wins. And I think a lot of that self-defense business and why didn't you get out of the car and who was really responsible for this? I think they need only prove that Zimmerman was more responsible than not for what occurred. And given that he made a lot of bad choices about getting out of the car and things like that, I think they've got a heck of a claim on a civil case. But that's quite different from the Justice Department giving two bites at the apple.
Do people want that in your research and your polling? Do people want the government to get involved in this, or is it time for them to walk away?
I think there's a lot. There's huge racial polarization on this. I think if you're white, you tend to look at this and say, you know, this was self-defense. If you're black, I think you view these events through a narrative of. There was a really moving discussion that the attorney general said about how when he was a kid, his father warned him, you know, if you're out, you have to be extra, extra careful not to look the least bit suspicious. And after this, he said he had the same conversation with his own kid. So we all view everything through the prism of our own experiences. And I think what a lot of people don't, and I think white people miss this more than blacks do, is the extent to which the experiences of people who are not white are fundamentally different. And that when you're in the majority, it's very easy for us to think, well, race has nothing to do with this because it never occurred to me. Whereas I think if you're black, race occurs to you all the time because it's always an issue.
Right, and I think that there's a lot of conversations going on in black households around the country, very uncomfortable conversations, parents with teenagers.
Who say, well, I may be outraged by this, but to my kid, what I want to tell him to do is to not act out and to be very non-threatening, because if I'm a mom or a dad of a young black kid, first and foremost, I don't want my kid to get hurt.
But that's a narrative that has escaped this whole debate, I believe. That there are families that look at Trayvon Martin's parents and think, this couple poured into this child for 17 years, loved this child for 17 years, raised from birth 17 years. Now it's gone. They look at their children now across the dinner table and think, they could be gone tomorrow because I didn't teach them to not act like Trayvon Martin, which was just wear a hood, walk around in the rain. So we've been told, right? Mm-hmm. It's sad and tragic that we keep overlooking them. And the Zimmerman camp is looking at Trayvon Martin's parents as almost as the enemy, especially when they bring the civil suit. We're dealing with it. Just two teams, and that gets lost. The parent narrative gets lost.
You have to empathize with both sets of parents. You have to realize that they are there with their kid and who they know, who they have grown up with, and who you can make a perfectly defensible, you know, Trayvon Martin is just going out to pick up some candy. Zimmerman is out trying to protect his neighborhood, and his neighborhood has been hit by burglaries. And you have to recognize, you know, there may be a little bit of a little overzealousness in him, but you have to recognize that his motivation in doing that is fundamentally a good thing. He's taking civic action. Unfortunate circumstance, you know, and one person ends up dead, and that's the tragedy of it.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that he took his job as a neighborhood watchman a little too far. They have 50-plus calls to non-emergency lines of this, that, of a garage door being open, this, that. He took the neighborhood watch thing a little too seriously, but that is not against the law, nor is following someone, nor is approaching them on a rainy night with a weapon. It is not against the law.
But, and again, this is where my own experience as a police officer comes in. I remember the extensiveness of the training of under what circumstances can you draw a weapon? Under what circumstances can you shoot? How do you try to defuse a situation rather than escalate it? All of that is part of the reason why the 911 operator says to Zimmerman,
"We don't need you to do that.
Sit still." You know, maybe the operator could have said, you know, been more reassuring that we're going to handle this. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, the prudent thing, and I can tell you over and over, you see something suspicious, the police want to be called. But if a citizen gets engaged personally, it's almost always the case that no good comes from that. We'll be back to wrap this up. This is the Think Tank News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
All right, Doc, hold on. Let me get this right here. Mexico, good, safe to travel. Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, absolutely nothing good comes of that. How am I doing so far? Good recap?
Yeah, I'd say that's
Check us
succinct.
Out.
But we got 10 more minutes. So.
Oh, man, we better think of something to talk about. You know, the Queen. I found this fascinating, the Queen of England. She's got a lot going on. She's got a great-grandbaby being born at some point. Hopefully everything goes
And the
well.
First time, gender won't matter.
Right, absolutely.
I guess they decided that it was okay to have a queen instead of a king, given that the current monarch, the queen, has been in there for 60 years.
Right, and then above that, I almost said speaking of queens, that would have got us in a lot of trouble, so I won't say that. they have passed, the queen has signed herself, they're okay with gay marriage. Gay marriage is legal. Same-sex marriage is legal. Why are we so far off the curve here? Why are we behind them? We should be leading the crew. We're the crazy kids in the world.
I think because we have a federal system. And we have a system whereby that's 50 separate decisions. And that's what is evolving. We have a situation evolving where pretty quickly, more or less, we're going to end up with legal gay marriage in the blue states and not in the red states. And it may evolve past that incrementally because the sweep of public opinion on that issue is extremely dramatic. And even amongst evangelicals and even amongst very conservative Republicans, among the youngest group, there is widespread support for gay marriage. So this is going to evolve. And it has evolved, as I've said before, more quickly and more in one direction than any issue I have ever seen in 30 years of following public
opinion. Well, I think that both same-sex marriage and legalization of marijuana coast to coast, they're just going to hold hands and skip all the way to the finish line. It's coming fast, and it's going to happen. It's a wave if you try to get in front of. I think you're on the wrong side of history.
Gay marriage fast, I think marijuana more slowly.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Marijuana, it's interesting, has, and our whole culture of prohibition, you know, what's very interesting about that is that it has a moral basis. And this goes even back to pre-turn of the century, and I mean the 19th to the 20th, 1890, sure, right, thereabouts, 1900. In that neighborhood of time, alcoholism, for example, came to be seen as a moral failing rather than a medical issue. Mm-hmm. And if it's a moral failing, then the people are to be condemned and the the solution is to be found in their own soul. So, for example, there was a tie together of the women's Christians temperance movement.
Okay.
And the right of women to vote was seen as largely these were, a lot of these were the same people. And so drug use still has the aura of a moral failing, which was also attached to homosexuality, though that one is fading quickly. I think it, with the onslaught of science and showing that, look, this is genetic. We can look at genes. We can see stuff in a microscope that's very predictive. And it's hard in the face of that degree of scientific evidence to continue to treat it as a moral failing.
Okay, but I don't understand how we would see the two differently if you go on the moral failing from an evangelical side, as most of the evangelicals will say that homosexuality is a moral failing, and they aren't going to walk lockstep with those flaming liberals, as they call
it. Oh, and indeed they haven't. Indeed, the evolving position is, well, okay, there may be a genetic predisposition mm-hmm. to homosexuality, but you don't. If you act on it, it's a sin. That's among
the same thing, even if they say there's a predisposition for alcoholism, but if you act on it, it's the sin. Yeah. It's the same. I think that six of one doesn't really half the other. I think from the evangelical side, that's the way that would be looked at. But like I said, they're on the wrong side of history.
Yeah, I don't question that. I would observe empirically that the speed, the velocity by which those two things are changing are different. And the gay marriage thing has, for a lot of reasons, just become a huge tidal wave. I think my best explanation of that is we sort of reached a critical mass of people coming out in their own families. And more people discovered that they have somebody in their family or a close friend or something else.
We're talking
gay.
Like 2-3 degrees of separation
instead but
of
close enough that they know them.
Right.
Okay. You know somebody and you're friendly to them and you find out they're gay and it's hard to have that degree of venom. We went through, for example, in politics, we had a couple of elected officials in Arizona who were elected first, widely popular, then got outed. And
right.
These are folks who probably, when they started their careers, if that was widely known that they're gay, probably would have never won because it would have been, you know, Jim Colby, gay person, whatever.
Sure.
But it was Jim Colby, respected congressman who I voted for 20 years. Oh, he's gay. Oh, big deal.
Right.
You know.
We always knew. He's such a nice boy. Yeah. So you handed me a little sheet of paper here. It says gay marriage now a Dem wedge issue. What in the world does that mean?
Well, a wedge issue is an issue that's put on the ballot by one party because of who it's going to bring out to vote. And it's interesting that gay marriage is one of those issues that until about a year or so ago was a predictable wedge issue. That you'd put the Republicans would put that on the ballot because it would bring out the conservative religious right to vote against it. And while they were voting, they would vote for all the Republicans. The tidal wave on this issue has been so immense that my guess is by 2014, that's a wedge issue for the Democrats. So you may very well see a legalized gay marriage initiative on the ballot in Arizona, not only to have the effect of promoting gay marriage, but having the incidental effect of bringing out more people who are liberal in their orientation and have a propensity to vote Democrats. It may add a point or two to the Democratic side, which is a complete reversal of the way it's been for the last 30 years.
I think it's coming in every state. I think it's going to happen in the majority of states in 2014. It'll be at least on the ballot. I don't know if the Dems are rallying, saying this is our time. This is our giant wedge here. This is going to help us. I think it's more public outcry than anything else.
You got to remember, most states can't put stuff on the ballot.
What?
That the initiative. This tended to be only in the states that were admitted to the union relatively late. It was the reform movement of the early 1900s. And states like Arizona went into the union with the provision that allowed them to put initiative, referendum, and recall were the three big reforms. Most eastern states don't have those.
So let me ask you this. off topic, it goes to your answer you just said there. Why don't we have national ballots? Why can't we have a national vote on gay marriage? Why can't we have a national vote on legalization of marijuana?
There is no provision in the United States Constitution to do that. Remember, the rules of the game matter. They matter big time. And it's one of those things that I hearken back to and will continue to do as long as we're on this show, because it seems to most people like insider stuff, but unless you have an overwhelming majority on one side or another, things like how you draw district lines and how you run financing and all those very arcane kind of things have a huge impact. For example, to take in the case of districting, in the last congressional election, the Democrats got 1 million more votes than the Republicans, and the Republicans control Congress. And you know what? They're likely to control Congress until at least 2020 when they have another census and they draw those lines again.
Got to play the rules of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And believe me, the Democrats did the same thing when they were in power. So the Republicans were in power in most states. They drew the lines in a favorable way. And as a result of that, they've got a lock on the U.S. Congress.
Real quickly, I want to keep it local here. One of our alumni, Arizona alumni, if you will, Janet Napolitano, stepping down from her department, her post at the head of Homeland Security to take over the UC system, UC collegiate system out in California. Where'd that come from?
Wow. She has faced down Al-Qaeda. She's faced down a hostile Republican Congress, but she doesn't know what she's in for. She has yet to face the internal dynamics of a Berkeley faculty. Remember what Henry Kissinger said when he went to Washington? He said, I love it here, as opposed to at Harvard. He said, here in Washington, they stab you right in the front.
Oh, I'm telling you, Napolitano, she can't finish her job as governor, can't complete it off as a Homeland Security Secretary. I say she goes and works for the D-backs because their bullpen can't finish a game to save the season. Ha! Take that! Hey, thanks for being with us, folks. I hope you've had a great weekend. We sincerely appreciate you taking time out of your weekend to be with us. On behalf of the entire crew here at KTAR, Dr. Mike O'Neill and myself, this is The Think Tank. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.